Hey there, web or podcast listeners. I'm Vermont Edition producer Matthew Smith, and I wanted to let you know that this podcast has been edited to make it a little bit shorter and a little bit sweeter. Thanks, and I hope you enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Here's something you don't hear every day. The first ever recordings of the wind on Mars. Now, if you were driving, that might have just sounded like your snow tires on the road, but how cool is that? That recording is from the Mars InSight lander, which touched down on Mars last month. According to NASA, sensors on the spacecraft detected the wind vibrations and recorded the wind sounds in two different ways. The recording was processed and amplified to make it a little more audible for us Earthlings. One InSight Science team member says the lander acted like a flag in the wind. As a flag breaks up the wind, it creates oscillations in air pressure that human ears perceive as flapping. And the flapping of the lander's solar panels are what you just heard in that recording of the Martian wind. That's so cool. And it's just one of the exciting bits of news about space, other planets, and the cosmos that came out in 2018. So here to give us a tour of other exciting happenings on Earth, in orbit, and beyond is John O'Meara. John, what a pleasure to have you with us today.
Delighted, as always, to be here.
So John O'Meara has been teaching physics and astronomy for a decade at St. Michael's College in Colchester, and most recently was the chair of the physics department there. But John, you're moving this month, like within days, I guess?
Yeah, at the end of the month.
Wow, he's already taken over as chief scientist at the W.M. Keck Observatory in Hawaii. It's really an exciting thing for you, a very sad thing for us, because we have so enjoyed having you here on Vermont Edition.
Well, it's been one of the highlights of my career, being able to work with you folks over the last decade, and it will hurt to leave.
Well, maybe we can do a field trip to Hawaii.
Absolutely. Standing invitation.
So that wind that we just heard, that's pretty cool to listen to, isn't it? I mean, it just sounds like wind, I guess, but it's neat to know that it was on Mars.
It's amazing to me. Yes, it sounds like just a simple little wind going through your ears, but to know that that's coming from a thing which we landed on another planet that then sent that sounds back to us is just amazing.
That's what, 300 million miles away?
Something like that, plus or minus a few.
How cool and how technologically advanced is it to think that we have something that not only has made it to Mars, but is actually sending things back to us? I mean, we have the power and technology to do that. That's amazing.
Yeah, it never ceases to amaze me whenever we send something that far and it works that well. Because when you look at Mars InSight or any of the other things that we've landed recently, this is not an easy thing to do. You send a spacecraft off, hope that you aimed right, and then everything has to happen autonomously because you're so far away that the spacecraft has to do its own thinking and its own landing. It has to do it just right. And historically, we've only gotten it right about half the time. So every time we put something out there, I get real nervous. And I watch the live stream from JPL, or in this case, I watched on the tarmac at Burlington Airport, and our flight was delayed. So I got to watch the landing. And it's really nerve-wracking, but amazing to see when they pull it off.
But John, I can't even send a text reliably from my home in Moncton to, you know, my family in Maine because the cell reception is so bad. And yet we have this thing sending sounds back from 300 million miles away.
Well, we need to just start aiming the deep space network at your house, this network of giant dishes.
Yep.
And if we could get an orbiter that's tailor-made to relay the communications, we might be able to fix it up for you.
Who do I talk to about that?
I'll give some calls over at NASA.
Thanks. So remind us, this was just less than a month ago that this InSight lander actually landed on Mars. And you mentioned it's a pretty remarkable thing. It had to do it on its own. It's obviously autonomous. We haven't sent people there yet. So how did that actually happen?
Well, so the spacecraft has a variety of ways that it has to go from going very, very fast, because we send things off at a great rate of speed and we don't want to be waiting decades for it to get to Mars. It has to go from going very fast to effectively no speed at all on the ground. And it does this through a variety of ways. It first uses Mars's atmosphere to slow it down. We call that aerobraking. And there's a heat shield that gets up a few thousand degrees in temperature. And then it jettisons that heat shield because although Mars's atmosphere is thick, it's not thick enough to slow it down enough. So then it deploys a big parachute, a really big parachute, and that slows it down a bit. And as it gets to within a few hundred meters, I believe, of the ground, then it fires retro rockets that will slow it down and gently bring it down to the surface. And that's what InSight did. And InSight is not a rover. It will stay where it has landed for the rest of its mission. It's a very different mission than a rover mission. So it deployed its solar panels and is now just about to deploy the seismometer on the ground. It's going to measure Martian earthquakes. And it's actually going to send a drill down, I believe, 15 meters down into the surface to finally learn a lot more about the interior of Mars, using a lot of the techniques that we use here on Earth to understand the interior of the Earth.
What about ever getting something physical back to Earth from Mars?
That was one of the highlights of this year is that NASA and the European Space Agency, ESA, signed a memorandum of understanding, you know, legalese, to say that they're going to work on a sample return mission. So the idea would be that you send one spacecraft there to look around, dig things up, put them in a canister, and then you send a second spacecraft to basically land, pick up the canister, and go back. And from the perspective of fuel, you kind of get to Mars and then you've run out of fuel. So this is tricky because we have to land and still have enough fuel to launch back off the surface and get all the way back to Earth. So it's going to be a very difficult mission, but they're really starting planning it right now.
And do you have any sense of when that might happen?
No, I don't. I believe it's the target for the return would probably be in the mid-2020s.
Okay, so still within our lifetimes, we hope.
Oh, yes. I mean, I'm hopeful that we have boots on the ground before we're done here.
But like human boots,
human
feet in them.
Absolutely.
You think that can happen?
I think it can.
Like in the next couple of decades.
I think we could do it in the next couple of decades. It's nuts. There are some serious technological issues to get over, but I think it's mostly a question of determination and money.
So we've talked about Mars a little bit. Boots on the ground, you say, money, technology is already being worked on. Let's talk about other institutions, companies, for-profit companies that are doing work to try to get to different places in space. I mean, it used to be NASA was it, at least in this country. You've got the Russian Space Center, Space Mission and Space Organization as well. We've got Japanese and other state-run organizations, governmental organizations that put money forward and work on this. But this has really been the year in some ways for different kinds of missions and organizations that are working on this who are non-governmental organizations.
That's right. Probably the best known of them is SpaceX, Elon Musk's company. And SpaceX had a really good year. I believe they've had the most launches, successful launches of their corporate history. And they also launched a new type of rocket this year. This is called the Falcon Heavy. It has a nice big metal sounding name. And this is their entrance into being able to lift heavier and heavier things up, either to low Earth orbit or potentially to send them beyond Earth orbit to places like Mars. And so
things that are heavier than a Tesla.
Things that are heavier than a Tesla, although that's what they used as their test mass with Spaceman and Elon's previous car, although he probably still says it's his car. but it was an amazing launch to watch because it's one of those things when it's a brand new technology, the probability is that the thing would have a failure. And so to actually see it work as well as it did, two of the boosters came back and landed in Florida right after the launch. So this is intended to be a reusable vehicle. And it was just really exciting to see yet another new entrant in. And there's another company that just had a successful launch for NASA of a bunch of CubeSats. So these are much, much smaller satellites. They used their Electron rocket and it was launched out of New Zealand. So there's a lot of new partners coming into the industry to eventually take human beings up into orbit instead of NASA or relying on the Russians and the Soyuz rockets. So, you know, next year, both SpaceX and Boeing are going to be testing their crew capsules in January. They'll do it uncrewed at the beginning, but then we may be putting people in the Crew Dragon or the Boeing capsule, whose name I forget, and bringing them up to space station instead of on the Soyuz. And this is important for a variety of reasons. One, just because it's important for us to have Americans going up on American rockets. But the Soyuz.
Why is that important?
I think it's important because it's a reinvestment in the whole industry here and industry with a capital I, in the sense that NASA touches so many sectors of the American populace that knowing that Americans are going on American rockets is really important to some folks, and also just when SpaceX is doing it and when other companies are doing it, it may be a lot less expensive so that we can be spending some of that money on technological development to get to Mars and beyond. So it's really exciting to see these things happen, and I wish them all the success so that NASA can go and focus on doing the more impossible things like boots on Mars.
You know, I've heard this conversation, though, happening in two ways. One is, you know, this could be really great to have for-profit companies that are not connected to the U.S. government be doing this kind of technological advancement, and competing can be really good because you get, in some cases, better technology because there's that competition, because the money is coming from a different place. And maybe it's cheaper, as you mentioned. But then there's also a sense sometimes that the U.S. isn't investing enough in NASA and in space exploration, or not investing in the right ways. Do you think overall it's a good thing to have separate for-profit companies doing this kind of work that, at least previously in previous generations, was the purview of state-run space organizations?
Well, I think for the reasons that you outlined, it's potentially less expensive, and it takes some of the technology development and technology maintenance pressure off of NASA so that it can apply its resources in other places. So if we want to put human beings on Mars and return them safely, that's really a NASA endeavor. I know SpaceX has designs on it, but it is a very, very difficult problem that requires huge leaps in technology and investment in infrastructure and things like that. And really, I think only NASA can do those kind of things, at least right now. We want to build giant space telescopes to find out if there's life on other planets. Only NASA can do those things. Putting human beings in low Earth orbit has been going on for 50 years now.
Do you want to do that?
I've been told under no circumstances am I allowed to leave the surface.
This is not a told by your superiors at work. This is told by some people you live with.
Yes. My family has decided I'm not allowed to go to space. But I think letting industry be competitive in bringing people to low Earth orbit is good for their industry, and it's good for NASA, because as long as we continue to invest in NASA at the same level or please more, then NASA can do the impossible.
Let's go to Brianna, who's calling in from Warren. Hi, Brianna. Go right ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. So I'm just trying to understand if you think that it's going to take both the government, so like NASA, and a private corporation as well, in order to get to Mars, or it's going to have to extend both beyond those and into international territory as well.
Do you mean for humans to get to Mars?
Yeah.
Okay, so what about it, John?
Well, I think the most likely outcome is that when we put human beings on Mars, it will be an international endeavor. I think that that the cost, just in terms of dollars, is very, very large, but the technological investment that needs to happen for us to do it safely and bring them back is very large. And the scale of that problem and just the return to humanity of such a mission would be better if it was an international endeavor. So I do think that companies like SpaceX will start sending things to Mars. It's not clear to me whether or not they're going to be sending human beings first or things like that. Elon Musk, I think, was quoted as saying he'd be happy to die on Mars. But
that could happen. I mean, realistically, if somebody goes, there's no guarantee they're going to get back successfully.
That's right. But that's true. At the same time, anybody gets up in a controlled explosion that sends them a few hundred miles up. And in fact, we saw that this year. One of the things that happened this year was that a Soyuz launch to the space station was aborted midway through. And they did a very, very rapid descent from the spacecraft, and the astronauts fortunately came back alive. So, you know, do I discount the possibility that SpaceX or a different company could get there first, in air quotes? No, we've counted them out before and we've been wrong. But I do think that in the end, my money is on an international collaboration with NASA leading the way.
So we got a question from Julia in Weybridge, who says, for the last few nights and early mornings, I have seen a super bright something in the southern sky. I think it might be a satellite, as it moves ever so slightly, but not quickly enough to be a plane. And it's always predictably in the same place every night and morning. It seems to blink or rotate in a kind of double helix, very bright and prominent. Any ideas of what it could be? I'm super curious to find out. Could it be Oumuamua? And she says, probably not, but Got any ideas?
I'm guessing it's not a Oumuamua. Usually when we see very bright things in the sky, especially if it's just after sunset or just before sunrise, it's usually Venus. Venus is so bright in the sky that it will be confused for many other things. It could also be any one of the other planets, Jupiter or Saturn, for example, are very bright in the sky. But if it's moving perceptibly, then it's very likely not. And for that, I wouldn't have a good explanation. But were I to guess, it's probably one of the planets in the solar system.
Now, Julia mentioned Oumuamua. Let's talk about Oumuamua because a lot of conspiracy theories surrounding this, a lot of exciting things we can imagine. First of all, what is known about it? What is it?
Okay, so Oumuamua got a lot of attention and for good reason. It is the first instance that we know of experimentally, like we verified, at least with orbital mechanics, that Oumuamua came from a different solar system. So it's basically an asteroid or a comet-like thing. The exact structure of it isn't very well known. But because of the trajectory that it came into the solar system with and then is leaving the solar system with, we're pretty sure it came from a different solar system. It was ejected from a different solar system. So it's truly an interstellar traveler, our first one that has come through the solar system. It's probably,
and that's partly why it's named Oumuamua. That's
exactly
a Hawaiian word that means traveler.
I believe it's traveler, yeah, something like that. And so this is probably not the first one to ever come through the solar system, but it's the first one that we've seen. And then it got additional interest because when we looked very carefully at how Oumuamua was moving, we realized that the velocity, its speed through space was slightly off. It was not what we were predicting given what we know about the solar system and about how gravity works. And so people went into speculation as to why this was. And one of the speculations was that it's actually an alien ship that's using what's called a light sail, which uses the radiation pressure from stars to move it like wind does move a boat on the ocean. Now, I'm going to go out on a limb and say it is probably not an alien ship. Given the data that we have in hand, this was a reasonable way of looking at this problem.
And you're hardly going out on a limb by saying probably not. You're leaving yourself a big wide gap there that it could be. I mean, does anybody saying absolutely not a manned spacecraft from another solar system?
Okay, I'll put it at 99.9% confidence
okay.
that it is not. But we can't rule it out. And that's an important thing about science, not just about Oumuamua, but we have to be skeptics, healthy skeptics of just about everything. But every hypothesis needs a test, and we can't exclude it 100%.
That's so cool to think about, even if you're probably certain it's not a manned spacecraft of some sort. But the fact that it could be, I mean, that does leave a lot of openings.
Sure.
Do you think there's a possibility that there could be a manned spacecraft somewhere trying to get somewhere else? I mean, what's your perspective on life in other solar systems, other galaxies?
I am much more confident that there is life abundant throughout the universe than I am confident that Oumuamua was not an alien spacecraft. And I can say that because of experiments, many of which got some highlights this year. We now know with great certainty that there are abundances of planets around other stars, exoplanets. In fact, it's very likely that every star has a set of planets around it. Now, not every star is good for life in its vicinity, but one of the missions that ended this year, the Kepler spacecraft, found thousands of exoplanets around other stars. And this year we launched a new mission to follow it up called TESS, which is looking at nearby stars to us to look for rocky planets around them. And we happen to be sitting on a rocky planet. So every time we look, we find more and more hints that planets are abundant out there, that many of them are at the right distance from their stars to hold liquid water on their surface and an atmosphere. And we see the building blocks of life out in the interstellar medium and in comets and in things like that. So the statistics are pretty good. We don't have any definitive evidence of life elsewhere in the universe. We have to remain skeptics. But I'm personally involved in a mission concept that wants to go out and look for this and find that evidence. And just given the number of stars in the galaxy, the number of galaxies out there in the universe, I think the probability is pretty good that life is abundant and that intelligent life by extension is probably abundant. but I don't think they visited recently.
And we got a note from a different John, I assume, John O'Meara, because this John who wrote to us says, I think it's a huge waste of resources to be in space, especially going to Mars. There needs to be a push to put money and research into making Earth a better place to live and sustain it for future generations. So, John O'Meara, how do you justify your life and career here?
Well, I mean, I certainly understand John's desire to better the world. I agree with it. I fundamentally agree with it. But I think that space exploration, astronomy, just the search for knowledge out there is a critical piece for that. You know, as an educator for the last decade, you know, I don't expect most of my students to go on and be astronomers or astrophysicists, but some subset of them might get interested in science and technology and engineering. Or take that and then go be a doctor, or take that knowledge and go be an informed member of Congress. So just because I'm doing astronomy, which may not be immediately obvious as to the return to society, I hope that I've helped to inspire some people to go down a path that will benefit society. And also, you know, at a basal level, human beings are explorers. This is how we've gotten to cover the entire Earth, to put people on the moon, bring them back, and to constantly be hungry to explore. So I think we're appealing to a very innate sense in us to want to be explorers, to look up at night, to ask whether or not we're alone. And I think that has value. It has just as much value as a good book or a great piece of music. Should we stop doing those things as well? I don't think so. Yes, some of these things are expensive, but lots of things are expensive, and it's a question of values and what we value investing in. I think we can do both, and I think we can do both and some other things we can do a little bit less of and be a better society and benefit just about everyone on the planet. So
you and I have also talked in conversations we've had for But Why, the podcast for kids, about things like the Mars rover and how technology that's used and developed by NASA with that big budget then does wind up getting used in more practical ways on Earth as well, things like driver cars, right? Mm-hmm. That all kinds of technology. Could we imagine things like water filtration and air? You know, how to sort of filter oxygen? Those things that people are trying to figure out in terms of how to have a long mission to Mars. That could wind up back here on Earth as we look at an increasingly polluted and difficult planet to live on.
Absolutely, I think if we want to have a human presence on Mars or on the Moon, that's more than just a transient thing. You know, a couple days. You're going to have to learn how to survive in very harsh environments, which means you're going to have to be very good at conserving energy, food, water, the basics of life. And developing better solar panels could very easily have a great impact down here. You know, developing better batteries would have an immense impact down here. We could have much less reliance on dirtier forms of energy if we can store it longer from natural sources. So those are things that could very easily scatter down. You know, advances in propulsion technology could be translated to commercial industries here. And I certainly think that the first time we put human beings on Mars, it will be a very inspirational moment. I know that everybody that was alive in 69 when they landed people on the moon know exactly where they were, and they were amazed. They were inspired, and we just have to keep doing that. It has a huge return on investment that isn't tangible in that instant, and we must keep doing it, in my opinion.
We got a note from Brad, who's president of the Northeast Kingdom Astronomy Foundation, who says there's lots of excitement about exoplanets with the Kepler mission wrapping up and the TESS mission getting started. We are doing ground-based follow-up of exoplanet candidates right here in Vermont at Northern Skies Observatory in Peacham, and involving both high school and college students in this work. P.S. The bright object in the morning that Julia mentioned in her email, Brad says, almost certainly Venus.
It's almost certainly Venus. I agree. And I'm thrilled to hear that folks are doing exoplanet follow-ups here. I mean, exoplanets, especially certain types, can be followed up with small telescopes on the ground anywhere on Earth.
How? What do you do?
Well, for the same thing that happens during an eclipse, you know, oftentimes the planet will go in front of its parent star. And if you just count the amount of light coming from the star, star and you see it dip, it'll typically dip by about 1% or so for a large planet close by its parent star. And then if you just watch it and wait for another dip, then you've got to guess at how long that orbital period is for the planet. And you just wait for a third one. Once you see that third one, boom, you know you've got a planet or something orbiting around that star. And this is what the Kepler mission was doing on Mars. It was doing for a few hundred thousand stars at once. This is what TESS will be doing for nearby stars all over the sky. And so, you know, this is a growth industry, exoplanets. And there's a lot of theoretical work going into that as well. And a lot of very big telescopes trying to look in greater detail at some of these exoplanets, both on the ground and in space. The Hubble Space Telescope, the James Webb Space Telescope will definitely do it. The WFIRST Telescope will be doing it. It's going to be a big part of astrophysics going forward.
What's the coolest news in 2018 that came out of the exoplanet study?
To me, it's just how wrong we were when we thought solar systems should look like our own. Every new discovery that
we have. That's so human, isn't it?
Yeah, it's so human. I mean, we're finding more and more systems that have stars and planets in what we call the habitable zone, this Goldilocks spot near their star. The frequency of planets in that zone just keeps going up. And so I think to me, there wasn't one signature moment for exoplanets. I think it's just more that we're getting really good at finding them now. And we're getting so close, both technologically and just in the science, to being able to look at the atmospheres of some of those planets and seeing if there's things like oxygen and water vapor and carbon dioxide and methane and ozone. Because when you see all of those things together, you've got a pretty good chance that there's life on those planets. And we're tantalizingly close to being able to do that. And that's what's exciting to me is just the story we've been building up over the last 10 years that's getting very close to a crescendo.
Let's go to Bob, who's on the line with us from Rutland. Hey, Bob.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to ask you, guess you mentioned the Kepler probe. Is something I read about a while ago, the Project Blue probe to Alpha Centauri, is that continuation, different? What is it?
I'm not familiar with that exact project. I know there has been some interest in there's a specific member of Congress, for example, Congressman Culbertson, who was very interested in building up the technology to send a probe to some of the nearest stars. Proxima Centauri is the closest star to the sun. It's part of the Alpha Centauri system. But this would be a very long mission. that it takes light 4 years to get to Proxima Centauri. And a spacecraft, any spacecraft we can imagine building now or even in the next few decades, would take much, much longer than those 4 years. But that's one of the things we have to begin to think about is sort of century-long missions instead of year-long missions. If we really want to go out and explore firsthand the universe instead of doing it via indirect means like astronomy, we have to start thinking about how to build those things. So,
if we're talking about a century-long manned mission, is mm-hmm. that a situation in which you're actually, you know, you're actually reproducing and creating new humans over the course of that mission who then have to carry on that mission? I mean, that child is born with a very specific purpose in life.
This is teetering into the realm of science fiction, but not really so much. If we wish to go great distances, we must either figure out amazing new technologies, which we can't even conceive of now, or we must commit ourselves to things like generational ships who would have generations go through their entire lives on board for that purpose. And that's a very different way of thinking about
life.
I don't know if we're ready for that at all, but it may be part of our future history.
Let's go to David in Chester. David, you have a question today?
I do. I'm afraid it's a little mundane compared to the thing you've been discussing. but earlier this week, a few days ago, there was a spacewalk to investigate the hole in the space station. And I was wondering, when they were cutting the material around the capsule, they were throwing off a lot of debris, little slips and shards of the fiber. And I've read over the years that there's a concern about the amount of debris in space, and I was kind of startled how much stuff they were just throwing off there. Can you comment on that, please?
Yeah, I didn't actually watch the spacewalk, but I know and I know about the concern, and I certainly share it, because the space station is going around the Earth at about 5 miles a second. So a small piece of debris going 5 miles a second can do a lot of damage. When they repaired the Hubble Space Telescope, for example, in its most recent repair mission, they had to take 111 screws off of one of the instrument bays to get the instrument out, and they designed this special capture plate for those 111 screws for precisely this reason. I'm sort of surprised to hear that they let stuff fly off while they were working on station. Hopefully they had they were trying to grab it and by other means. But this is a very serious concern, and it's only going to get worse as we put more stuff up there and as we put smaller things up there. You know, SpaceX, for example, is talking about putting up a constellation of CubeSats to provide internet all throughout the planet, but that means we have a lot more stuff up there. And if things break in space, then we have to worry about them as space junk, and we worry about the damage that they could do. So a new industry is being formed in figuring out how to deal with space junk. So it is a problem. It's going to get worse, and we have to figure out how to solve it.
Brian is calling in from Montreal. Hi, Brian. Go right ahead.
Hi. My question for John is pretty off the topic maybe, but I'm 70 and I've been looking up at the sky all my life from here in the city of Montreal. It's been getting so much harder all the time to make any sense of what's up in the sky just because there's so much light in most of the industrialized world. As chief scientist at the Keck, do you have any opportunity or any plans to try and alert the people who can't see the sky with their own eyes to understand better what you and your machine can see and what it's doing on an ongoing basis? Otherwise, I fear the pure science that you'll be doing will become more and more alien to the majority of people here on Earth. Can you tell us a little about your plans for 2019?
Well, that's a great question. But before I jump into my plans, I think, one thing to look into, there are societies. The International Dark Sky Association is very concerned about this problem of we call it light pollution. And this is definitely something that we are, as astronomers, are concerned about, but I think that everybody should be concerned about, because I agree with you. Everybody wants to look up. Everybody wants to be inspired. As for my job, that is a key part of my job, is to communicate the science that our observatory in particular is doing, but to communicate astronomy to anybody who wants to hear about it, and sometimes to those who don't, because it is such a wonderful science. It is a science that anyone can do, provided they have a dark spot and a little bit of time at night. And I think it's one of the most wondrous endeavors human beings can have, is to look up, be inspired, and wonder what's out there. So I take your comment very seriously, and I hope going forward that I can continue to talk about how excited I am about it, and to make sure that we keep doing this wonderful science.
Okay, but we only have a minute left. What are you going to be doing at the Keck? We want to know.
So my job is basically to help ensure the scientific productivity of the observatory, to communicate to all the different people, the astronomers, the board, the various funding agencies, all of the people who interact with the observatory, what we're doing and the importance of the science, and then working with those agencies to help ensure the safety of our field going forward, the funding that the government provides to astronomy to build instruments for our observatory, for other observatories, and to ensure that we can continue to do the world-class science. Keck is the most scientifically productive observatory on the ground, and we want to keep that legacy going. And I'm just thrilled to be asked to be a part of it, and I can't wait to get started.
Well, John O'Meara is now chief scientist of the W.M. Keck Observatory. It's in Hawaii, so it's about as far away from Vermont as we could get with still being in this country. John was the chair of the physics department at St. Michael's College. We are really going to miss having you on Vermont Edition. Thank you so much for coming back, and best of luck with the new job.
Thank you so much. Thank you to everybody here at Vermont Edition and VPR for having me over the years, and I hope to find an excuse to at least call in the future.
Good. If we get John from Hawaii, we'll know.